What in tarnation is a fossil word?
What on earth is a petard, and how could you be hoisted by yours?
Why do figments only appear in our imaginations?
We shall not give you short shrift as we attempt to eke out another wordy, nerdy episode of Words Unraveled. Welcome to another Words Unraveled. I'm Rob Watts from the YouTube channel Rob Words.
And I'm Jess Zafaris, author of Words from Hell and Once Upon a Word. And today we are going to talk about fossil words. We're going to do a little bit of etymological excavation and dig up the origins of these interesting terms.
But where we need to start there is with what a fossil word is, because people might not realize that that this is even a term.
That's right. When I introduced this on my TikTok channel, people didn't quite know what they were either. And I think they also, there's a little bit of misunderstanding around it. Some of the comments seem to just think that they were archaic words, which in many cases they are. But a fossil word is a word that primarily appears in the context of a phrase or an idiom. And it's mostly only found in that phrase or idiom. There's some variation, can be more than one idiom, but typically it's a contextual word. A good example is in the phrase to and fro. We don't typically say fro anymore, but it was a preposition and adverb meaning away or backwards in Old English.
It's basically akin to the word from. Actually, just on that, I found this one as well. And did you know there was a word you used to be able to use to describe someone, which was froward? So not forward, it's spelled very similarly, just swap a couple of letters around. Froward.
Excellent.
And to describe someone as froward was to suggest that at every possible opportunity, they went in the opposite direction to what was required of them or desired of them. Basically, to describe someone as froward was to say that they were a pain in the ass. They were difficult.
Rather contrary. Really
contrary is a perfect example of it. Yeah, so that is a really good example of a fossil word, because fro only really exists in that phrase, to and fro. And fossils are a really good metaphor for this, because these are words that are remaining traces of something that has gone before.
It reminds me of lexical skeuomorphism. Are you familiar with that concept?
I am not.
It comes up a lot. Skeuomorphism is when like a newer piece of technology uses iconography or elements or design from an older piece of technology. So if your phone camera makes a shutter sound, there's no reason for that, but it reminds us of the older piece of technology. Or like in Photoshop, all of the tools use symbols and icons of earlier pieces of technology. The cut and paste uses scissors. A word processing app might use a pen tool as a logo. So I feel like fossil words are sort of skeuomorphism, but for words.
And that makes me wonder if things like, you know, the pod in podcast could be considered a fossil, or will one day be considered a fossil, right? Because you reach a point where a certain generation doesn't know why that element is there, because they weren't around for the original technology, right? They don't know that the pod in podcast is from iPods, because they were the only place that you could play them to start with.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And you know, to what extent will people use the term iPod in the future except to refer to the older piece of technology?
Probably not. But some more fossil terms then, or fossil words. What have you got for us, Jess? I've got a few in my back pocket, but I'll allow you to go first.
One of my favorites is also an unpaired word, or an orphan negative, which we had been talking about in an earlier episode, but it's inclement weather. It's from the Latin clementum, which means placid or mild. So inclement weather is weather that is not placid or mild.
Right, because you can still talk about clemency, can't you? Which is the same origin, right? That is mercy or whatever. Yeah, we talk about inclement weather. Another one is ulterior motives. Mm-hmm. We don't use the word ulterior in any other context, so far as I know. But at some point, it was just as common as the words interior and exterior.
What is that, that ULT element?
Yeah, well, that is just a variation on the prefix ultra. So where interior is in here, exterior is out there, ulterior, ultra, area, right, is beyond, because ultra means beyond. So it's something that's even further away than exterior to where you are now.
That's neat. That's also, that element is also interestingly and surprisingly in the term outrage. Have we talked about this before?
Let's do it.
Outrage doesn't include the words out or rage, but it's actually from the Latin ultraticum. And it was morphed into outrage in French and then became misinterpreted or misheard as outrage, basically. So the Latin word means like extraness or ultraness. So that's why outrageous fashion, for example, is out there, but it doesn't make you rage.
Yeah, exactly.
What are some other fossil words that you know of?
Well, a lot of them relate to old practices that we don't have around anymore. And these are just sort of words that are left over. A really good one, albeit a slightly morbid one, is the word shrift in the term short shrift. Do you know about this one, Jess?
No, tell me.
Okay, so shrift was a confessional that you do with a priest. It could also be the...
No kidding.
Yeah, it could also be the absolution that you got from that confessional. But in the term short shrift, it refers very specifically to the practice of giving someone who was about to be executed, who was bound for the gallows or for the chopping block, I don't know, is that what you call it? A short opportunity, an all too short opportunity to be absolved of their sins, to be able to give their confessional. To give them short shrift was to do them the disrespect of not allowing them to absolve themselves of the crime and the sins that they had committed. A good quote including it comes from the Walter Scott novel, Quentin Durward, from 1823, where one of the characters is a king, right? And he says, "I pray you, tell my kind cousin, if he loves such companions," by which he means thieves and vagabonds in this sense, "he had best keep them in his own estates, for here they are like to meet with short shrift and a tight cord."
Ooh.
So he's saying that he would be ruthless with these thieves and vagabonds. He would give them little opportunity to absolve themselves of their sins before they're given the tight cord of the rope of the gallows.
Ooh, that is dark. I have another one here that relates to crime, a couple actually. One of them is on the lam, which means on the run. Lamb here is a little unknown, but there are a couple interesting possibilities. In the Elizabethan era, it was lamb was both a verb meaning to beat and a noun meaning a heavy blow. So on the lam, which was originally American crime slang, might literally be implying the same thing as the term like beat it for getting out real quick, absquatulating, so to speak.
Absquatulating, another great word.
but this might also be related to the word lambast, which we had a Twitter discussion about not too long ago, right?
Because yeah,
you say lambast, right? I also...
Absolutely, and I've never heard it pronounced otherwise.
Apparently, it was originally lamb-based, and some people do still pronounce it that way. And it's a duplicative or repetitive term, because lamb here means beat, and bast or based was an older word for beating, unrelated to the word based, as in like putting liquid on your food.
Yeah, I was gonna say lamb based sounds like something you'd do before a Sunday roast.
But lamb, apparently lamb. It originally meant to beat the tar out of somebody, essentially.
Wow.
Now it means like to verbally do so. And then the other one that I have that's related to sort of like American thieves slang was the phrase kit and caboodle, which caboodle doesn't come up a lot.
Yeah, that's a good one, because I know a little bit about this one. And this one is not a traditional fossil word, right?
It's almost like a humorous construction. It, because boodle is the word that we're really like aiming for here, and the phrase the whole boodle sometimes also comes up in like thieves slang, and it's from basically the same word in Dutch, which meant property. So like kit and caboodle apparently was a term for collectives in several contexts like sports, the military, fishing and sailing. And kit here might be like a wooden vessel. So kit and caboodle could imply like the whole ship and its cargo.
Yeah, I think the k is just there to give it a sort of flourish, right? To make it a bit more satisfying to say kit and caboodle, because boodle is not a word mm-hmm. in English, right? There's this Dutch word boodle, but it doesn't exist in English. So why not add a k to the front of it if we're playing with words that don't really exist? And that's what makes this, they call this a born fossil, right? A word that only exists in a certain context, but has never existed outside of that context. I've got a few more of these, actually. Nother is a really modern, well, I think of it as a modern one, right?
A whole nother.
That is the only context in which the nonsensical word nother ever appears, right? Because you never have to split another up in that way. It's also a nice modern example of re-bracketing, isn't it?
That's happening, what I was thinking.
Happening uh-huh. before our eyes. And druthers is another one. To have one's druthers is actually have one's would rathers.
That comes up in the American South quite a lot.
Yeah, actually, it's not a term that I knew before I came across it while looking up these Bourne fossils. But those are Bourne fossils, so they haven't existed in the sort of wider language. But there are plenty of other fossil words that had these sort of traditional ones we've been talking about. And I already gave quite a morbid one. Can I give another morbid
Yeah, let's
one
hear it.
Before we move on. What a treat for listeners and viewers as Rob takes us through all of the most depressing words that he can think of. Okay, this one is death knell. You don't talk about a knell in any other context, do you, other than death knell?
I don't think so.
So a knell is a tolling of a bell, a ringing of a bell, a slow and sort of mournful ringing of a bell. And a death knell is the ringing of a bell when someone has died. This is an old practice. You know, if someone died in the village, they would ring the church bells slowly to announce the fact that someone had died. And they would also do the same during the funeral. And that's where death knell comes from. They would also describe this ringing of the bell as the passing bell or the death bell. But yeah, if you say it sounds the death knell for something, what you're saying is it marks the passing of that thing. It is really the final nail in the coffin, the straw that breaks the camel's back. I mean, we can go for all sorts of alternative idioms.
The only context in which I can think of Nell being unfossilized is in Edgar Allan Poe's The Bells. And, you know, it's got that repeating bells, bells, bells. And at one point it says, keeping time, time, time as he knells, knells, knells.
That's lovely, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Isn't that nice? And we should, I suppose, caveat everything that we've talked about with the fact that if someone does have an extraordinary wide vocabulary, then they might be using some of these words. But, you know, general usage, that they're not going to use that often.
One thing that I've noticed lately is some of them tend to become unfossilized if we start using them in sort of a tongue-in-cheek way. One in particular is vicarious, which is typically used in the phrase like living vicariously. But lately people have been started applying vicarious to other things. You're vacationing vicariously on behalf of someone else or something along those lines. And that one's also kind of funny because although we typically associate vicarious behaviors with living, it was originally applied to dying, Jesus dying vicariously for humanity's sins.
Oh, wow. Okay. I had no idea of that. I remember coming across the word vicarious while studying like A-level psychology. There was a concept in there called vicarious reinforcement, where you reinforce a behavior via something else. But yeah, I didn't know that there was a sort of biblical root to that one.
Mm-hmm. It means like taking the place of someone. It's also related to the word vicar, perhaps.
No.
And for the same reason, like someone who stands as a either a representative for humanity or embraces Jesus's vicarious dying.
Oh, right. Why? So, not like a sort of vicarious conduit of the word of God or something like that.
I mean, I'm sure same concept there.
Yeah, that's nice. Vicar and vicarious are related. That's, if I take nothing else away from this episode, I'll be happy with just that.
One of my favorite fossil words, too, because I think of the context in which it appears, is figment, which like figment of your imagination. And figment means shape. So a shape that your imagination takes.
And you sometimes hear people say pigment of the imagination, right? And actually, these fossil words are a really good way of generating something that we've also talked about, eggcorns. Because these words don't exist outside of the context of these idiomatic phrases, people struggle to pick up on them, and they replace them with words that they are already aware of from elsewhere. Two that we've already talked about in other episodes are desserts in just desserts. People don't really talk about getting their desserts normally, even though, you know, it's a fairly sensible nounification of deserve, right? What you deserve are your desserts. There's only one S in the middle of there. And also champing. We don't hear champing really outside of the context of champing at the bit, but champing is actually it is really just an alternative to chomping. So when people say chomping at the bit, it's not that wrong. It does mean sort of to chew at. A horse is chewing at the bit in their mouth. I found a really nice quote, including champing, though, from a time when it was, you know, more appropriate to use it beyond just the phrase champing at the bit. It was in Tobias Smollett's rather hilariously named The Adventures of Peregrine Pickle. There's a particularly misanthropic character in there who says, "Why didn't nature clap a pair of long ears and tail upon me that I might be a real ass and champ thistles in some common?"
Oh, that's lovely. That also reminds me, it's in champing also appears in The Hobbit during the riddle scene. The riddle is white horses on a hill, they champ, they stamp. And I don't remember the end of the riddle, but the solution, I believe, is teeth.
Ah, okay. So I'm calling it a fossil word, but actually, maybe it's not. Or
semi-fossil.
Yeah, exactly. There's still remnants of the original organism out there, yeah.
Another one that people tend to egg corn that we may have addressed in that episode was is bated breath. It's related to the word abate, but people will sometimes misspell it as B-A-I-T, like fishing bait, which kind of makes sense because you're kind of on the hook, but that's what makes it an egg corn, right? It's understandable that you would make that mistake, and we don't use bait outside of abate.
Yeah, that's right. It has a logic to it. And actually, you could go your entire life saying bated breath, meaning it with an I, and just get away with it. Yeah.
Right. A lot of people won't catch
it. No one need know.
A similar one to bait and abate, bide in bide your time. We use the word abide, which is related to that. And it prominently reminds me of the Coen brothers film, The Big Lebowski, the dude abides. Or in the South, sometimes we'll say we can't abide such irreputable behavior when someone isn't living up to our expectations of them. But we don't typically use it without the A. So bide in that case is the fossilized word.
So to bide your time, what does it mean?
It's a Middle English or Old English term meaning to stay, so, or to continue. So if you're biding your time, you're waiting, you're remaining and you're awaiting the perfect moment.
Ah, so when we say abide with me or sing abide with me, are we essentially saying stay with me, mm-hmm. wait with me?
Yep. The dude abides because he's just chilling. Living through life.
I've never heard that one before. That, I mean, it sounds incredibly American.
Highly recommend The Big Lebowski if you have the opportunity to watch it.
I'll take the recommendation.
A similar one that is fossilized for similar reasons, and we discussed this in the rebracketing episode, is to eke out. Phrase eke out, and it's related to the word nickname because that was originally an eka name, and eke here and eka meant to increase or to lengthen or to have something additional on top of it. So a nickname and an eka name were additional names, and to eke out is to increase or lengthen something.
That's it. Have we stretched out that one?
I think we have. Eke a little bit more content out of it.
What about beck and call? We don't talk about beck very much, mm-hmm. although actually it is just a variant of beckon.
Which is funny because like we consider that an egg corn when people say beckon call instead of beck and call, but it's more or less the same word.
Yeah, it is, but you need the and there because you can't have a beckon call because a beckon is supposed to be a hand gesture, right? It's supposed to be a silent gesture of, I'm doing a little curly finger gesture, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that, a beck or a beckon, you know, it can be any silent gesture that indicates a command.
And the difference there is just parts of speech, right? Like beckon is more typically a verb and beck is more typically a noun.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but we've lost one and kept the other.
Interesting. One that comes to mind is kith and kin. We don't use kith very often, but this is a repetitive phrase. It's just an alliterative reduplication almost, because kith was a word for like your people or your kinsmen as well. So kith and kin is my people and my people.
Yeah, the way I sort of interpret it to give it a little more credit is that kith is kind of your friends. And kin is your family. I think that's kind of the idea. It's like saying friends and family. But we've already got an alliterative phrase for that, friends and family.
Right.
So we don't need kith and kin as well. Yeah, and also Run Amok. Mm-hmm. That's one.
Ooh, that one. That is the one that I have. That's a little bit of the on the darker side.
It's a bit mucky, is it?
Yeah, it's not. It's not great. It's not great. This one's in the chapter on bias in my book Words from Hell. It was originally applied by Portuguese tradespeople to people in Malaysia and Indonesia. Apparently, some Javanese people in the 1500s were known to run around the streets and kill people. And these writings in Portuguese use the term amuco to describe them. It's based on a Malay word meaning to attack furiously. And apparently there was kind of a mass hysteria spell of this for some reason at the time. Not sure what the deal was with that, but people who were being described might have had like a psychological condition of some kind. And indeed, amok in the late 19th century was a term for a psychiatric condition that caused like violent sudden behavior. And it's described as what they call a culture-bound syndrome.
Oh.
The trouble is that saying that someone is running amok is to compare them to like frenzied, murderous Javanese people, which is obviously problematic and a little bit on the racist side.
Yeah. Does that mean I have to stop using it?
I mean, I don't think that anyone actually connects it to that now. I would maybe ask someone who is Javanese if they find that term offensive and then, you know, go from there.
Yeah. If we stop using every term that originates somewhere offensive, you know, we're going to have to watch. I mean, we have to watch every word even more than we already do. Oh, I'm starting to sound like my dad.
It's when it comes to those things, I'm like, I try to be mindful of it. And if I run into someone who finds it troubling, then I correct myself and move on.
Do you say amok or do you say amok?
Typically, I say amok, which interestingly is closer to the original Malay spelling, which was A-M-U-K. But I hear you saying amok,
yeah,
which is closer to the English spelling.
Well, actually, though, so amok is spelled A-M-O-K, often, not all the time, obviously, which is quite close to the Javanese spelling. But amok can be spelled A-M-U-C-K, and that's because of conflating the word with the word muck. Mm-hmm. Right. And you can find examples of the phrase being run a muck rather than run amok. You know, that again, a re-bracketing issue. It's one of these things that just keeps coming up. People have thought that, oh, that a is actually supposed to be an indefinite article rather than it just being the start of the word amok.
Another funny re-bracketing one is in the phrase that I associated with the Looney Tunes cartoons and Yosemite Sam saying, "What in tarnation?" Which is this like, you know, stereotypical Texan phrase. But it's kind of funny. It's a re-bracketing of the phrase "by the eternal," which was then shortened to tarnal, like he paid a tarnal high price for his dilly-dallying, you might say, something like that. But then it probably has influence from the term darnation as well, which was like a softening or a minced oath variation of damnation.
Damnation. Mm-hmm. What's in tarnation? I think that one maybe counts as one of those Bourne fossils,
yes,
as well,
absolutely.
Right? Because mm-hmm. it doesn't exist in it. It's never existed in broader English other than in that context. But I'm glad it does exist.
Right. I love that one.
How would Yosemite Sam be able to swear on children's television? Oh, I've got another good one.
All right.
This one has a little sort of rude edge to it.
All right.
Hoist by his own petard.
Oh, I love this one. This is great.
Yeah. Okay, so It's Shakespearean. The term hoist by his own petard. In fact, in Hamlet, it is hoist with his own petard, but we sometimes say hoist by his own petard. And a petard, well, actually, I'll let the Oxford English Dictionary tell you what it is. It describes it as a small bomb made of a metal or wooden box filled with powder used to blow in a door, gate, etc., or to make a hole in a wall. So it is a small explosive device, right? A petard. Actually, in French to this day, petard is like a little banger, you know, something that a kid might throw on the floor to make a bang. And also actually has the same root as the French for to fart, which is
uh-huh. That's one of my favorites because it basically means like thrown in the air by your own fart bomb, so to speak.
it does a little bit of... By the way, the French also have a really good word, which is péterade, right? Which literally means to fire a load of gunshots at once, like a fusillade. But
oh, interesting.
But that's neat. It can also mean to emit a whole stream of farts.
Oh, fabulous. I love it.
Yeah. And so Shakespeare, Hamlet, hoist with his own petard. What is the line here? It is, "For 'tis the sport to have the engineer hoist with his own petard," because Hamlet is talking about turning the tables on the people sent to assassinate him.
Right. So you're basically blown up by your own bomb. Interesting. Yeah. The diagrams of petards are very interesting, especially the Elizabethan or medieval looking ones.
Sorry, the diagrams.
I have looked up diagrams of petards.
Anarchist's cookbook. What is this?
I find them really, they're really neat because it's like you almost stick this conical shaped object onto a door or a rampart and it forces the explosion into the door and punches a hole in it. It's like a siege breaking device, which is really neat. But you can also imagine that at that time, an explosive of that kind could also very easily backfire.
Jess, I'm forever surprised by your pastimes, looking up explosive diagrams.
Of course.
I should stop being surprised.
Endless curiosity. We both enjoy that.
Yeah. Any more of these, Jess?
Let's see. This is a born fossil, but I like the word a lot. So let's cover it. The whole shebang is one of my favorites. No one knows exactly where shebang came from. Probably fanciful. That S-H-E ending is sometimes used for emphasis on other words. It is found in Walt Whitman, 1862, used it as a word for a shelter. And that's probably the gist of this phrase here. He said, "Besides the hospitals, I also go occasionally on long tours through the camps, talking with the men, etc. Sometimes at night among the groups and around the fires in their shebang enclosures of bushes." So maybe it's a rudimentary enclosure or a space, but it's also been recorded as a word for a tavern. And then at Yale, students would use it as a word for a dorm or a public hall. So the gist of the whole shebang is like the whole room or the whole place.
I was interested to hear you say that it had been used to mean tavern, because it reminds me a lot of the Irish word shebeen, which is also used in South Africa to describe a sort of informal bar. Right, an illicit bar, I suppose. Yeah,
they may be related. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's not a big leap, mm-hmm. is it? And I actually can't think of another word that is closer to shebang than shebeen.
Another one is the fettle in fine fettle.
Oh yeah, what on earth does that mean?
A fettle in this context means like condition or shape, and apparently this is a Lancashire dialectical word for that, probably from the Old English word for like a girdle or a belt. Interestingly, so if you're in fine fettle, you're like buttoned up.
And indeed, if you are in fine fettle, you could be described as hale and hearty. And hale is another fossil word that specifically that spelling H-A-L-E, because hale means really healthy, and it means free from injury, because it's thought to perhaps be a Scots version of the word whole, right? And whole in Old English could not only mean entire, but it meant free from injury. It meant you were, you know, physically whole. You hadn't got any bits that have fallen off.
Right.
Haven't got any big gashes down the side of you or anything. You were hale and hearty.
Oh, that kind of reminds me, just going back real quick to hoist by your own petard, one of my favorite facts about the word hoist is that it is the verb form that corresponds to the noun heist. So a heist is literally like lifting somebody something, so to speak, which, you know, you can also say that like stealing something is to lift it off of someone. Same idea.
Or you hold up a bank.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Exactly.
Which is to commit a heist.
Interesting.
Yeah, commit a heist.
I like it.
I love this stuff. I love when all these words all come together in this neat little packet. Another one, batten down the hatches.
Ooh, yeah. What is battening?
Yeah, well, actually, you can think of the word baton, right? B-A-T-O-N. And you think of a big sort of, I don't know, big wooden or metal bar or something. And actually what a batten is a big wooden block that's used to hold down, a door.
That one's spelled B-A-T-T-E-N. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. So baton is B-A-T-O-N, right? And batten down the hatches is B-A-T-T-E-N. Although I bet you any money that that's been egg-corned.
Oh, probably. Yeah. And that feels like a French versus English spelling. too, of similar ideas.
They could very well be the same word, actually.
Mm. Another one is the lo in lo and behold. We see that in the Bible unfossilized in other contexts, but if you're just talking in like everyday speech, typically you would only use lo in lo and behold. And that's it's a verb form of the Old English word for to look. And it could mean basically anything. Like, it was just an exclamation. It could be excitement. You could say it in greeting. You could say it in surprise and joy and grief. Just whatever tone of voice you put on low, it can mean whatever you want.
That's brilliant. Do you have any more?
Sure. Let's see. I have two more, I think. Okay. One is the turpitude in moral turpitude is from the Latin turpis, meaning vile, foul, or ugly. So moral turpitude is literally utter depravity and vileness.
I don't like the, I don't even like the sound of the word turpitude. I don't know. I don't like it. So I'm not surprised to find that it means something foul.
I agree. A little slightly better one, a little tidier, is spick and span. Do you know what spicks and spans are?
Well, I mean, I hope spick means something other than
it's
than,
not
than what it means.
It's fortunately not related to the cultural term. It's not a slur in this context, fortunately. It was a word for a nail, and then a span was a word for a wood chip. And the idea here is something that's freshly cut from a workman's hands, like a brand new nail or a freshly chipped piece of wood. And this is, both of these are Germanic and probably from Old Norse, but span also appeared in the phrase, the 17th century phrase, span new, which meant the same thing as brand new. Same idea with brand new too, is like a freshly hot branding iron.
So does that mean that's kind of a double fossil word there? That's two for the price of one in spick and span.
Indeed.
Very good. And lo, have we reached the end of this edition of Words Unraveled?
I think we have uncovered most of these words of yore. There's another one for us.
Go on. one last bonus.
It literally means of years, and it's from the Old English word for formerly or in former times.
Oh, yeah. And while we're talking about time spans, in the offing is another one as well. We don't talk about the offing, but the offing just means the near future.
Offing to me sounds like murdering someone.
Yeah, it does. Luckily, it doesn't mean that.
That's good.
I guess we hope you will join us in the offing for another episode of Words Unraveled very soon.
And if you can think of any other fossil words and want to know about their origins, let us know in the comments if you're watching on YouTube, and drop us an email at wordsunraveledpod@gmail.com.